1968 to 1977 years, which we intend to, hope to and intend to publish early in 2008 to help commemorate the 60th anniversary of WHO. And Socrates has been working like an absolute, I shouldn't say Trojan perhaps, I don't know, but he's been working very, very hard and has
got it diligently,
and he has got an almost final draft already written. So it's been a tremendous piece of work by Socrates in his own right. At the same time, our new Director General, Margaret Chan, made it clear in her first days in office that primary health care is an element of her new manifesto. Her plan for the coming years will certainly take a second or new look at primary health care and how that can be revitalised for the benefit of public health in the 5 years and perhaps more from now. So this is an ideal way to connect back with Socrates' presentation, which is dealing with the origins of the primary healthcare movement in which he himself played a very important role as the probably the first chief, I guess, Socrates.
Well, it's actually the program area leader, yeah.
Okay, of the primary healthcare program here in WHO. So he's got a little bit of a provocative title here in the sense of, did it get off to the best of starts? Perhaps not, and if not, why not? I'm going to just let him take the floor in a second, but I just want you to know we're recording this session primarily for the benefit of having it available to anyone later who hasn't attended, but your own comments may well be recorded too, so you should be aware of that in advance. Socrates, I think, will speak for about 35 minutes or so, and then we'll open up for your comments and questions. Socrates, thank you for coming. It's all yours.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you for coming as well. When I learned of the revived interest in primary health care, I had no choice but to push aside the other ideas that I had for this seminar in order to concentrate exclusively on what I think I've learned about the subject from my recent writing assignment. I do this with pleasure, for if there's any subject about which I feel obsessive, it is that of PHC. From the title of my seminar, it's obvious that I have some misgivings about the way primary health care was launched by WHO. Putting it briefly, it was ahistorical, confusing, and didn't respond to what the governing bodies wanted. But before going into that, let me provide some background for those of you who are not familiar with the history that led to the holding of the International Conference on Primary Healthcare at Alma Ata in September 1978. I should add that my presentation today is totally separate, as much as one can say such a thing, from my official history work, mostly because of what I want to say is both personal and speculative. Primary healthcare was presented to the WHO governing bodies in January 1975 in a paper entitled Promotion of National Health Services. I had the privilege of being in charge of the team that prepared that paper, at the same time that I was made program area leader of a new unit of primary healthcare in the Division of Strengthening of Health Services, whose director was Dr. Kenneth Newell. The paper to the board, which the board of January 75, argued, I quote, a series of major national efforts to develop primary healthcare services at the community level is seen as the only way in which the health services can develop rapidly and effectively. This development was to be guided by seven principles, which stress the need, one, for primary healthcare to be shaped around the life patterns of the population, two, for the local population to be involved, for maximum reliance on available community resources while remaining within cost limitations, for an integrated approach of preventive, curative, and promotive services for both the community and the individual, for all interventions to be undertaken at the most peripheral, practicable level of the health services by the worker most simply trained for this activity, for other echelons of services to be designed in support of the needs of the peripheral level, and finally, for primary healthcare services to be fully integrated with the services of the other sectors involved in community development. At this point, the history of primary healthcare became a bit complicated due to the insistence of the Soviet Union, transmitted by its delegate, Dr. Venediktov, at an international conference be held to review national experiences. As we learned rather quickly, an international conference is no small affair. The nearest experience that WHO had that was of any relevance was that of the World Health Assembly. But this was clearly several orders of magnitude greater in difficulty, not only because of the severe logistical demands that were made by the conference being organized in the Soviet Union, but more importantly because of the complex nature of the subject, beginning with what was exactly meant by primary health care. There were wide-ranging opinions on the subject. Among my colleagues, we had no doubt that primary health care's starting point was people. It was no accident that one of the documentary pillars of primary health care was Health by the People, published in early 1975 and edited by Newell. It is also of note that at one point I recorded Dr. Mahler as saying he could imagine that primary health care might best thrive where there were no organized health services. I don't think he meant that to be taken literally. Instead, it was a challenge to get us to think in terms of what people can do for themselves and what improvements to health can be obtained by actions outside the health sector. Nevertheless, statements of this kind added to the confusion surrounding what WHO meant by primary health care, a point I will get back to later. But first, I want to say something about how WHO ignored the historical roots of primary health care, which in and itself, in of itself may have added to the confusion. The historical roots of primary health care can be found in social medicine, a discipline that emerged in Europe during the 19th century. One of its leading 20th century advocates was Dr. Andreas Stampar, who in fact was deeply involved in the establishment of WHO to such a degree that he is often indicated to be the father of the organization. Stampar and other advocates of social medicine managed to have its essential principles spelled out in a report produced in a conference on rural reconstruction and hygiene organized by the League of Nations in 1937 in Bandung, Indonesia. In his oral history given in July 1975, in other words, not Stampar's oral history, but Dr. Van Zylhuijde, given in the same year that WHO introduced primary health care, Van Zylhuijde, a high-ranking American public health specialist and president of the World Federation of Medical Education at the time of Almaty, describes how he had recently read a document to some people in leadership positions in international health who were talking about community health, and he asked them how they liked it, and if it seemed to cover what they had in mind. They all agreed that it did, and at least one of them thought that it was something that he had written and was testing on them. He then told them how it was excerpts from the report of the 1937 League of Nations conference. Somewhere in 1977, I ran across this report, just in time to incorporate it in a paper that I wrote for Dr. Mahler's signature, entitled The Promotion of Primary Healthcare in Member Countries of WHO. In it, I contrasted the outcomes of the conference in Bandung with the principles of primary healthcare as developed by WHO, and then went on to ask how come WHO had resurrected ideas that had been put forward decades earlier. I used the paper to expand on many of Mahler's most well-known criticisms of existing health systems, the delivery of medical care at the expense of health care, the lack of relevance of medical education to the priority needs of people, the imposition of high-cost technology at the expense of appropriate technology, to name just a few. There was another day, probably some around the same time, when a colleague came to me with a page from a report and asked me where I thought it had come from, just like Van Zylhuijde's experiment. The subject was provisions for popular participation in health work. The language was a bit dated, but the essential ideas were in the spirit of primary health care. The page turned out to be from the first expert committee that dealt with public health administration in 1951. Stampar was a member of that committee, as was Carl Evang, another prominent member of the social medicine community at the time. It was this committee that gave birth to what was called the Basic Health Services. Despite the model for the Basic Health Services that the expert committee developed in the 1950s, WHO's major efforts over the next two decades were in assisting member states to develop mass campaigns, with malaria eradication leading the way. Only when that eradication campaign began to seriously falter in the 1960s, that the leadership of WHO began to give more careful attention to the problem of how to develop basic health services. This was how Dr. Pierre Durolle, Deputy Director General, outlined the problem in 1964 for a study group that met to discuss the integration of mass campaigns against specific diseases into the general health services. The question before the group, he said, was creating an increasingly acute dilemma, particularly for developing countries. This was due to the fact that while there is a need to control or eradicate major communicable diseases, the general health services are at somewhat embryonic stage, and the development, their development would almost certainly be rather slow. He continued, there seemed to be a general agreement on the need for integration of health activities with the ultimate aim of providing one health program for the community intimately related to its social and economic development. The secretariat for the meeting was a joint one involving the Malaria Eradication Program and the Division of Public Health Services. The group was unanimous in their opinion that mass campaigns can and should be used as an instrument for the development of the general health services. However, there was a great lack of information regarding how to go about this. To meet this deficiency, they called for field and operational research. The last line in their report reads, "This is a challenging opportunity for WHO to stimulate and sponsor useful operational research." Between 1964, when this study group met, and 1971, there were no really significant policy advances in the area of basic health services, as far as I've been able to determine. Matters began to change in January 1971, when the executive board decided to focus their organizational study on the methods of promoting the development of the basic health services. The WHO secretary had not recommended this subject to the board. It arose out of their discussion with Dr. Venediktov being its principal advocate. Dr. Newell, who had joined WHO in 1967 as director of research of a research division, was made director of the newly established Division of Strengthening of Health Services in April 1972, at which point he inherited the responsibility of being the secretary to the working group that the board established to carry out the study, its study. Before Newell took on that responsibility, the secretariat had prepared a background paper on the subject for the board's discussion in January 1972. I've not, unfortunately, been able to determine who wrote this report. Dr. Venediktov asked for the name of the consultant who had written it, but no name was given in public. The paper presented a substantive analysis of the problems facing the basic health services, including that of the need to integrate the mass campaigns into such services. It sketched the policy basis for such services that they had, as they had evolved from the early 1950s. The longest section was dedicated to ways and means of promoting the development of the basic health services. The paper was low-keyed in its presentation, concentrating on technical problems facing public health administrators responsible for extending the coverage of natural health services. The board study group met during 1972 and produced their report for its January 1973 session. Whether the change in content and style can be attributed solely to Newell's influence is not totally clear, but everything was different about this report. The picture painted there was an alarming one. Its key conclusion was that the basic health services approach had failed and that a major crisis was on the point of development, which must be faced at once. The crisis was reflected in the widespread dissatisfaction of populations for reasons that included a feeling of helplessness on the part of the consumer who feels rightly or wrongly that the health services and the personnel within them are progressing along an uncontrolled path of their own, which may be satisfying to the health professional, but which is not what is wanted by the consumer. Mahler, in his first annual report of WHO, prepared in early 1974, continued in this dramatic fashion when he indicated that a turning point in the life of the organization may have been reached, which stemmed from the unequivocal admission that the most signal failure of WHO as well as the member states has undoubtedly been their inability to promote the development of basic health services and to improve their coverage and utilization. As there were few models to demonstrate that primary health care can come out of the villages at a reasonable cost and in a manner that is technically and socially acceptable, he indicated that it was an urgent task for WHO to seek a number of innovator countries that would be willing and able to set up such systems of primary health care and demonstrate their effectiveness. Five major principles dominated the report of the board study. The first was that while the problem of developing health services, the notion of basic having been dropped, is essentially a national affair, it should be possible to structure responsibilities to give greater emphasis to consumer preferences. Secondly, output should be seen in terms of the final return to the individual in health status and in service. Thirdly, to overcome the current fragmentary nature of the health services, they must be taken as a whole, public and private, national and international, curative and preventive, peripheral, intermediate, and central. Fourthly, the performance of the health services should be judged by health status, operational factors, for example, coverage and utilization, accepted technology, cost, and consumer approval. Lastly, believing it improbable that an international model or standard will be developed, each country will have to possess the national ability to consider its own position, problems, and resources, assess the alternatives available to it, decide upon its resource allocation and priorities, and implement its own decisions. Dr. Amundsen from Denmark, the board member who had chaired the study, introduced the subject to the Assembly in 1973. She underlined the fact that the study was no more than the beginning. An immense task lay ahead, not only to assess the real situation, particularly so far as concerns the primary health services at the peripheral level, but also to try to coordinate under a common plan the often scattered and disparate health facilities and resources that might be funded by the state, by local authorities, by private persons or institutions, and by bilateral or multilateral assistance. A holistic approach was essential if great disasters later in the century were to be averted. The resolution adopted by the Assembly in 1973 invited the attention of the member states to the findings, conclusions, and recommendations of the study, and outlined a series of recommendations for the Director General to carry out, beginning with concentrating upon specific programs that would assist countries in developing their healthcare systems for their entire populations, special emphasis to be placed on meeting the needs of those populations which have clearly insufficient health services. It also requested him to report to the board on the steps to be taken for the implementation of the conclusions and recommendations of this study and their impact on the future programs of the organization, but no date was fixed on such a report, when such a report should be prepared. For all intents and purposes, the subject was closed for the time being. This is 1973, May. At this point, I need to go back in time to pick up another major thread initiated by the social medicine community. And again, I turn to Stumpar, a fervent advocate for a broad developmental approach to improving the health of the rural poor. In a background paper that he prepared in 1954 for technical discussions of the Assembly on the subject of rural health, he reminded his readers how the experts of the League of Nations by the end of the 1930s felt more and more strongly that the questions of rural hygiene should be examined in their natural setting, because any real amelioration of the standard of health in the rural environment must depend in the first place upon the improvement of living conditions generally. However, in the ensuing two decades, he noted, the situation of the rural population had gotten increasingly worse. Paradoxically, this could be partly blamed on the rapidly increasing rural population brought about by dramatic reduction of disease. He described the situation in the following terms: the rural population is enjoying the first fruits of social medicine. This cannot stop at the first step. The responsibility of social medicine is to carry on and improve their lives. It cannot let die from hunger people whose lives have been saved from disease. I've mentioned the publication Health by the People, which was published in early 1975 and edited by Newell. That publication arose out of an initiative that dated back to 1972, when the UNICEF-WHO Joint Committee on Health Policy also chose to evaluate the basic health services. In addition to Health by the People, there was another important publication, Alternative Approaches to Meeting Basic Health Needs of Populations in Developing Countries, which also was published in early 1975. Both books highlighted developments in various countries, including China, Cuba, Tanzania, and Venezuela, along with one community-based project in India. But in Health by the People, Newell extended his analysis by including two other community-based projects, one in Indonesia, the other in Guatemala. All three community-based projects undertook activities that Stumpar would have wholeheartedly approved. One project featured goat and chicken farming to increase the income available to the poorest members of the community. In another project, the community was aided in finding funds for introducing tractors where farmers had lost their cows, and for installing deep tube wells. In the third project, community health promoters were trained as community catalysts working in areas other than curative medicine, such as literacy programs, family planning, the organization of men's and women's clubs, agricultural extension, the introduction of new fertilizers, new crops and better seeds, chicken projects, and improving animal husbandry. While Newell, in his comments at the end of Health by the People, expressed excitement at what had been demonstrated in all the projects written up, he was particularly enthusiastic about what had been achieved related to community development. He contrasted issues such as improving productivity of resources to enable people to eat and be educated, and the sense of community responsibility, pride, and dignity obtained by such action with the more traditional public health activities of malaria control and the provision of water supply. The challenge for people in the health field, he concluded, was to accept these wider developmental goals as legitimate ones for them to pursue, even going so far as to admit that without them, there must be failure. The 1937 League of Nations report had expressed a similar sentiment when it concluded that if the problem of land reform is neglected, programs of rural reconstruction not only will be greatly retarded, but will not be able to rest on a permanent basis. At the end of 1976, shortly before he left WHO, Newell wrote in a background paper for discussion with the Director General and the regional directors that primary health care was, I quote, a code word describing a health-related response to the international and national cry for social equality and justice, with equal emphasis upon the developing world and the underserved groups of many countries. Furthermore, he indicated, primary health care was not only a health concern because it is improbable that any organizational health service response by itself will be sufficient to significantly alter the poverty syndrome to the vast mass of rural populations. This conveniently brings me to my second problem that I see in this history, namely the confusion surrounding exactly what primary health care was supposed to mean, the confusion that I suspect some of you might be suffering at this moment. You will have noticed that the term primary health care was used on several occasions in earlier discussions. Mala spoke a few models that demonstrated how primary health care could come out of the villages and the urgency with which WHO should seek a number of innovator countries willing and able to set up systems of primary health care and demonstrate their effectiveness. Dr. Amundsen had talked of the need to assess the state of primary health services at the peripheral level, calling for a holistic approach to the problem, but without clarifying just how holistic her vision was. Did it go as far as Newell's, who wrote of agricultural development, literacy campaigns, the organization of men's and women's clubs, and the like? The ahistorical nature of the publications surrounding the introduction of primary health care approach left unanswered a number of questions that had been the subject of earlier debates. The basic health services model had failed, but no explanation was given for their failure. Was it the model that Stampar and Evang had proposed in the 1950s that was at fault? Or was it the inability of member states to carry out what had been proposed some 20 years earlier? And how innocent was WHO in all of this history? After all, its emphasis on the mass campaigns had pushed aside the basic health services. The outstanding problem of how to integrate the various vertical components that hitherto had been the pillars of WHO's program was no longer being addressed. Did this mean that it was no longer an important issue? As an aside, one could argue that the quick emergence of selective primary health care in the 1980s was not only due to external forces imposing that regressive vision on WHO, but to the fact that WHO had not focused on the question of integration once it started moving towards the concept of primary health care. The executive board had altered the focus of attention from the basic health services to the national health services, and in the process downplayed the importance of integrating the vertical program. And then Newell went further with his insistence that all factors contributing and affecting health had to be kept in focus as well. All these factors and unanswered questions must have confused many, especially the large number of senior WHO public health specialists in the organization whose career had been dedicated to strengthening national health services by the traditional means of improving human health resources skills, especially at intermediate and local levels, and who had struggled in various ways with the problem of integrating diverse programs into one national program. Looking back on the time, I see four major visions that were competing with each other at the same time for attention under the banner of primary health care. Two were holistic at the national level. One, the more holistic of the two, encompassed issues such as agrarian reform and anti-poverty strategies, while the other brought together all health facilities and resources funded from all sources, including private, bilateral, and multilateral assistance. The other two visions were also holistic in nature, but applied at the community level. One focused on the health services and involvement of the community, the other on empowering people and communities for broad developmental purposes. Depending on who was presenting primary health care and in what context, one of these main visions was concentrated on, sometimes two, almost never all four. it is not surprising that many were honestly confused about what primary health care was all about. This brings me to my third problem concerning how WHO chose to introduce primary health care in 1975, namely that it did not respond to what the Assembly had asked of the organization. It was not WHO's wish to make yet another report to the governing bodies in 1975. The board had concluded its study in 1973, and the Assembly had indicated that WHO should get on with the job of promoting the National Health Services. But Dr. Benedicto forced the issue when he proposed to the 1974 Assembly that an international conference should be held on the subject, and that the Director General should report to the January 1970 Board upon the steps which could be undertaken by WHO to further the implementation of this and related resolutions, and which could result in more effective coordination between WHO's activities and national health programs. His proposal for an international conference was not acted on but the need for WHO to report again was. The resolution that was adopted in 1974 could have been taken at face value. WHO could have chosen to concentrate in its presentation to the board in 1975 on its own activities. The timing, however, was an awkward one. Newell and many of his staff were deeply involved in the preparation of the Alternative Approaches volume and Health by the People. As a result, the paper that did go to the board in January 1975 was put together very quickly. It is possible that Mahler and his immediate advisors did not have more than several days to review its contents. What might have resulted from a more careful review of the subject is worth considering, I think. Like all good chess games that were played in the past, looking for better moves can be both challenging and informative. The paper could have taken into account Mahler's vision for WHO. Mahler, who had become Director General in 1973, had a different agenda in mind. Not that he didn't fully support primary health care. On the contrary, it was his more radical statements, as I've already illustrated, that encouraged us to pursue the direction that Newell had hinted at in his concluding section on Health by the People, which was more oriented to community development than to the strengthening of the health services, which, by the way, was Newell's mandate as director of SHS, another source of confusion, no doubt. Mahler was trying to redress the way WHO developed its programs. He was unhappy with the fact that the typical WHO involvement in a country took the form of literally dozens and dozens of projects that had little to do with each other, many, if not most, having been developed by headquarters staff. He was committed to try to convince countries to move towards a more holistic vision of their problems and solutions and introduce country health programming as a methodology to bring that about. He sought to make health an obligatory component in all country programs managed by the United Nations, as I described in my first seminar last year. He sought to get countries to use WHO to coordinate inputs from the international level that aimed to improve health. He envisioned a highly decentralized WHO better positioned to help countries coordinate the use of their own resources and those of the international community. Both Health by the People and the Alternative Approaches volume were in press at the time of the board, met in 75. These demonstrated the capacity of WHO to evaluate experiences in different political contexts. In effect, the conclusions reached in both of these publications represented a statement of the primary healthcare principles. The paper to the board could have presented these principles in the form of what the organization had learned from its review of experiences, while indicating its intentions to continue in-depth analyses of these and other situations, working with innovator countries, as Mahler had called for earlier, all to be undertaken within the context of Mahler's overall strategy for strengthening WHO's coordinating role at the country level. This approach would have brought together two types of analytic capacity that WHO possessed. One strong at working with issues related to people and communities, the other strong at working within the framework of national health systems. At some point in the late 1960s, I heard Mahler put forward the idea that only when change from below was consistent with a change that was coming from above would health systems begin to swing, one of Mahler's favorite terms for describing something good. It sounded good to me, which is no doubt why I remembered it, even though I wasn't quite sure what it meant at the time. The change from below would emerge from community involvement in health services and empowerment and development, while that from above would stem from any number of possible reforms as introduced by country health programming, intersectoral coordination, regionalization, health services, and manpower planning, to name just a few. The paper that could have been written in January 1975 would have described WHO's capacity to cooperate in both types of activities, i.e. from below and above, And most importantly, it would have portrayed WHO's commitment to ensuring that a top-down approach was sympathetic to the principles that were driving those promoting bottom-up change, something that, in fact, was not evident at the time, a point important to keep in mind, and one which I've addressed on other occasions over the past year. So what does all this history and speculation have to do with the situation that WHO faces today? To begin with, the problem of primary health, of what primary health care means, still exists. If you look at the WHO website and go to primary health care, the first definition that you see is a traditional medical one. Care which provides integrated, accessible health care services by clinicians who are accountable for addressing a large majority of personal health care needs, developing a sustained partnership with patients, and practicing in the context of family and community. I would not recommend, however, that WHO open up the Pandora's box of redefining primary health care. Instead, the Declaration of Alma-Ata should be taken as the starting point. Perhaps the governing bodies can be asked to endorse its basic principles with the idea that WHO bring the subject up to date with references to post-Alma-Ata developments of direct relevance to the future of primary health care. Even if such an endorsement is obtained, I suspect that vested conservative forces will oppose it. I have no idea what that opposition looks like today. When Dr. Mahler presented his ideas at a meeting in Bellagio in June 1977, Dr. Bell, who summarized the meeting, portrayed the opposing forces as, quote, massed phalanxes of the world medical professions in industrial and developing countries alike, who will oppose that idea with all their power and prestige. Assuming that there remains strong opposition to the underlying principles of primary health care, WHO must build the strongest working relationships possible with those organizations that are fully sympathetic with primary health care, especially civil society groups dedicated to people's participation and empowerment. In the 1970s, there was an extraordinary relationship built up between WHO and the NGO community committed to primary health care. Also important was the working relationship between WHO and UNICEF. However, I must add some caveats. With respect to the NGOs, I have the feeling that WHO is too nonchalant about their involvement. Rather than have taken their support for granted, we should have worked more closely with them to solidify their involvement in WHO's program. Similarly, with regard to UNICEF, there were continuous strains between the two organizations, beginning with an attitude on the part of many WHO staff that UNICEF was a supply agency and nothing else. There was resentment in certain circles of WHO when UNICEF decided to hire its own medical advisors. Perhaps WHO had taken too seriously its constitutional mandate as being the coordinator in the field of international health. If there are forces against primary health care outside the organization, you can rest assured that they exist inside as well. They were present in the 1970s, and WHO lost many staff members sympathetic to primary health care because their immediate working situation was not favorable to primary health care, despite the fact that the organization was promoting its principles. One way that was found at headquarters for involving all staff who were interested in supporting PHC was the creation of working groups that discussed various aspects of the subject. These groups lasted for a good while during 1976 and 77, but suffered the problem of not involving regional staff. In fact, the whole exercise proved counterproductive when the regional offices rightly asked how come headquarters had so much free time for its staff to volunteer to work in such groups. Today, one could well imagine, through the use of blogs and other means, inviting all interested WHO staff to contribute their ideas and suggestions. In the final analysis, however, it is what happens in countries that will determine whether this historical cycle of primary health care will fare any better than its predecessors. Here, I only have several observations to make. To begin with, WHO needs to ensure that all of its country-based activities and programs are operating in full sympathy with primary health care notions. This was not the case in the 1970s. Then, the vertical programs largely continued to function as before, indifferent to and sometimes hostile to the notion of primary health care. But more importantly, the planning tools developed by the organization were largely insensitive to the needs of primary health care. For example, the systems analysts then present, including myself, had not found a way to incorporate the social orientation of primary health care into their methodologies. Newell seems to have recognized this. In his first draft for the background paper for Alma-Ata written in early 1977, he labeled what the systems analysts and modelers had to offer as the hope of the 1960s, something which he claimed was no longer with us. For we had misunderstood the nature of the question we were asking and the capabilities of the sciences we were looking to for assistance. Mahler, too, often castigated us systems types. It was not only the systems analysts that failed to support what Mahler called the social revolution in health. The social dimension of health, as currently being looked at by the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, was largely ignored by the majority of programs and not actively supported by the organization when such support was critically needed. Introducing the social into the work of WHO cannot be simply mandated. It must be worked on diligently, something that did not happen in the 1970s. Socially sensitive health systems research is still needed in all four aspects of primary healthcare that I've described. As I explored in my last seminar, such research stagnated in the 1970s, precisely when WHO should have been leading the way. In each country where WHO is cooperating to promote primary healthcare and PHC-related ideas, there should be a historic alarm, which also was absent in the 1970s. In this regard, it might prove useful for historical reviews to take place in all member states. Such reviews could explore the degree to which each country has or has not engaged in the past the four visions of primary healthcare. In fact, this might be the way for WHO to begin building its future. Such a program would no doubt uncover many valuable experiences that have not as yet been documented or have been forgotten with the passage of time. In any case, what is most important, as I've already indicated, is that all WHO programs should be working in harmony with the basic principles of primary healthcare as enunciated alma mater. No doubt there are other conclusions to be drawn from this history, but I'll stop here. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Socrates. Some terrific points for debate and discussion in there. And we have a good half hour or more to get them aired. So the floor is open. It would be very helpful if you would say who you are when you speak, so that we can be clear on that. So questions, please, comments. Who would like to go first? Eugenio.
Thank you very much, Soko. I think it was very, very interesting, very inspiring. You have focused, and I think that's excellent, your perspective from the secretariat itself and its views and its thinking, its failures. But can you also make some comments vis-a-vis the member states and how do they really echo or not this, let's say, failures of the secretariat, and how in the middle of a Cold War, member states actually call the attention to the secretariat for being out or in primary health care. So a little bit on the member states and WHO as a quorum of member states.
Do you want me to get a few? Mm. Right, we'll take a couple of questions, and then Socrates will start to answer them together.
I just wanted to add to what...
Who are you?
Sorry. My name is Dave Ray, and I'm retired. I used to work here. And sorry, my apologies. And I also happened to have been in alma mater. So the interest in primary health care is rather deep. The other point, which has been a bit left out, as I think Eugenio mentioned, apart from the, shall I say, mechanistic ways of the how it developed, there was a tremendous, I think, I may be wrong, upheaval of support after the alma mater conference all around. This was among the member states, or at least quite a number of them, among quite a lot of the academia. At that time, you also went into some social medicine institutes and schools, and you saw everyone talking about primary healthcare. And among which we term civil society, at that time was more the NGOs. So there was a tremendous upswell of fervor and support for this concept. Where did it also, perhaps, it's beyond Soko's mandate now, but perhaps you can touch on where did it go astray that somehow it didn't gel? Obviously, WHO did not exercise its leadership, but that's a separate story.
Sir.
Michel Thuriot,
and I'm pre-Almata. Because I worked in primary health, in a village health workers program that had started from 1972 in Iran. And I would like Soko to bunk or debunk mythology. The myth, and it may not be a myth, you would know, is that village health workers, which was the extreme form of primary health care, shall we say, was introduced at the same time as China joined WHO, and that there was a link between the introduction of China and the pushing of village health workers, and Iran and other countries. I can't remember what other countries, but certainly Iran was one of the countries that wanted to try it. Now, this may be all sweet mythology, but if not, I'd be interested to have your views.
Madame?
Thank you. I'm Marie-Andrée Diouf, and I work for the Department of Country Focus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would be really interested if you could just elaborate a little bit more on the two suggestions that you made at the end of your presentation. The first one, if I understood correctly, was to start now with a kind of review of what in fact went on, mm-hmm. or is going on, right. in all countries, because from this social sensitive health research point of view seems to be a very good practical start. And if you could just elaborate what you mean, exactly, it would be very useful. And your second suggestion, I think, is probably even more difficult, and is to to see how programs. All programs here, especially our headquarters, could incorporate this primary health care dimension. And since we know that is perhaps the most difficult part, do we have any hint, something we could start with?
Thank you. Gentlemen, there. Do you want to stop now and we'll take the.
We'll have a pause
and then I know that there are two gentlemen here after
right,
that.
But before it gets too long. I don't really have, Eugenio has asked this question before, I remember well on the other seminar occasion, and I don't really have a good answer to that, because basically my work has been obviously working with the papers and not working at from any country perspective as to what was going on in those countries and how they saw them, in what way the country experiences and development were interacting with the organization, which in a way links with Michelle's point of village health workers and the entrance of China into the organization. Was this precisely the time that Danielle would be the one better to answer that question? But the notion of auxiliaries was there in the 60s. Now, whether they corresponded technically to the barefoot doctor or not, perhaps Danielle can address that. But there were many expressions in the late 60s that I felt, if taken at face value, would have left open the possibility that these would be village people, not terribly educated, but that you would be able to spend some time educating them, and they would be able to function well in the health terms. They would have a contribution to make in the communities, and that this was an acceptable direction to go in. So I don't have the feeling that all of this had to wait for China to come in, but certainly China's appearance obviously allowed that to really move forward much more quickly than it might have otherwise. Well, Dev is talking post-Almata, and I don't really have anything to say about that, but where did it go astray? That's part of the historical analysis. I think that may be the critical question in the historical analysis, because I'm sure that in every country there were progressive health people that were pushing all through this history back to the 20s and the 30s. There are many historians, medical historians now, that are looking at Uruguay and Emmanuel telling us what was going on in Uruguay in the 1910s and 20s in the maternal child health area. You look at that and you see the link with what was going on in South America and the League of Nations thinking. So no doubt that every country has a rich, maybe some other, richer than others, and that needs to be explored, but also explored in as wide a way as primary healthcare implicates. It means you need to get some social historians who maybe don't know that much about health, but who would be looking at development and be able to say, all right, you know, in the 50s we started to do this, but then maybe because of the Cold War, the thing clamped down and that was the end of it. Whatever the reasons, that kind of history may open up lines of thinking that are very well worth exploring. How to get programs for, I don't have much to say on that, no. Yeah, I think the last thing you want to do, is to try to have a police force approach, which is what I think the Health Programming Committee approach was at headquarters, to try to have at least the documents that were coming out to all kind of say, speak the same thing. And there was no way that committee could really control what was going on at headquarters, so I doubt that it's possible extending down the line that you could really get it so that everybody's reading the line, each report coming out of the country to see whether it's really. But something could at least be. Somebody might have that as a responsibility to just kind of look and see: are we making sense?
Right. I'm aware of at least four more questions, and in the order that I saw the hands. The two gentlemen here, Marta, third, and Maria near at the back, fourth. If that's all right with you, please. This gentleman here.
Me?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. My name is Fabio Quarto. I am a retired WHO staff. I have lived actually through primary health care at country level, at regional office level, and in headquarters. I think one of the conclusive remarks of Dr. Lissus, that I thank for his interesting and provocative presentation, was that all will depend on what happens or what is happening in the countries in the end. So what the countries, what's the situation in the countries and how they are going to reconsider the past, because it's not only WHO that met failures, but the countries have met also their own failures in the implementation of primary and difficulties in implementation of primary health care. So I think it is important, because what is essential, actually, we say it always, is the political will. The political will of the country to get involved is not only by signing a document or by agreeing on a WHO resolution. When you go to the country, you will have to find out, are they really meaning what they have signed, and how much effort and what kinds of resources they have allocated for developing primary health care. And by resources, I mean the human resources as well as the budgetary resources. How much freedom do they give to the communities to get involved in helping themselves? All these are things that need to be really analyzed and studied in the future. And it is very good to hear that WHO is considering, the Director General is considering reviving and rejuvenating, or whatever you can call it. And I think it is most important now is that we should not take for granted what is said in the WHOA and in the regional committees and so on. Because what is important really is that when the people themselves start doing, developing that, and what they have and how they are really convinced with the whole process. So I think it has to be taken country by country. I know that what I was talking about was an old kind of story, and that things has changed. Perhaps there are lots of changes in terms of availability of human resources, for example. You can say better than me in that respect. That's your field. But at any rate, I think there have been changes since then. And these will have to be taken into consideration in building the new systems for primary health care. So I think all the concentration, if we are going to really mean business and not fail again, is really to find out how we can help the countries in managing their program. I think, for example, the major failures were lack of budget, lack of monitoring, lack of human resources, a lack of logistics, essential drugs, these countries, I was working in Yemen, cut arrives at the amphetamine kind of drug that is taken by the population, reaches every village, while essential drugs never reach every village. You see, so why can they distribute cat and they cannot distribute essential drugs? So it is very important to see, that is political will, I think, you know. And at any rate, these are the major failures and the lack of managerial capabilities in the country, which really needs to be strengthened at all levels. But this is a developmental process that the country should really take part in. I'm sorry for this longish comment.
Thank you. Daniel?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Soko, and I appreciate very much hearing, listening to you.
Qui t'es, toi?
I didn't say, sorry, I'm Daniel Flacot. Excuse me. I worked for 30 years with WHO, 10 years in Africa, and 20 years in headquarters, in the division mainly of HMD, Health Manpower Development. And there, we had the pleasure to cooperate very closely with Soko, with Dave, with Jean-Jacques, with Amelia McGlacas, with Dave, etc., and many other friends that we work with. I wanted, Mene Soko, to have your views on the relationship in between primary health care and this slogan, this naive and a bit utopian slogan of health for all by the year 2000. That was the question I wanted to ask you.
Thank you, Martha. And then Maria.
Okay, I'm Martha Anker, retired staff. I guess for me, I wanted to hear something about sort of how, I mean, I don't think any policy can be either all right or all wrong. So were there any things that primary health care actually did right? Were there any successes? was there something that was good about it? Or, you know, how did that work compared to, you know, what were the things that didn't work so well? Because I think if it was a total failure, maybe it's a mistake to go back to it. No, I'm not, that's just kind of an aside. But I'm sure that there must have been some successes as well with this policy.
Thank you. Maria?
Thank you. First of all, I feel a little bit intimidated by the amount of experience around the table, and I would like to encourage for having this type of experience more often around. Probably it would be very good for all of us to change the opinions. My first comment will be around the slogan, as mentioned already by one of the persons who intervened before. I think we are all kind of children, and we have some complex around this slogan of Health for All of the year 2000. The complex is because that was such an incredible slogan. I think since then we've been all trying to develop new slogans to try to stimulate people around, and we came back with I don't know how many initiatives trying to emulate the incredible challenge posed by the Health for All for the year 2000. The second, and this will be my question, what's happened exactly when we decide to move from primary healthcare to something else? What was the reason for that? Did we discover something that was more successful? We decided to go into the disease control, and then we completely abandoned the primary prevention because we thought it was a kind of old-fashioned. What has replaced the primary health care, and essentially what happened for us to lose the common sense approach? Because after all, I think
Okay, thank you, that's great. We'll let Soko come back now.
Well, I agree thoroughly with what Dr. Parto has said. One of the frustrating things about writing this third decade book is that it's built on resolutions. I mean, that's the work of WHO, is to pass resolutions and then that defined, and the programs that really know well how to work with the governing bodies get substantive resolutions, substantive in the sense at least that it goes on and on and on, that this needs to be done, this, this, and the other. And that mandates the continuation of whatever the program was doing before. But as was pointed out, the delegates and the members that sign off on these resolutions don't necessarily have any obligation when they go back to their countries to pursue any of it in their own countries, which was what we were talking a little bit about before at lunch, before we came here, some of us. Which I think Mahler made that a big point over and over again. And I think that probably wasn't the best politic. I don't think preaching at the countries is going to change anybody. So I think, I think the notion of trying to come up with new resolutions to cover yet another aspect of whatever it is not self-defeating, but certainly a self-deluding process. I think it makes far more sense to try to, as you suggest, to go find out what's going on in countries and have an information system, terrible words, but information system that is sensitive enough to at least allow you to know which country is seriously thinking about doing something. So that then you mobilize the capacity that you have and you concentrate a little. I think Mahler had that idea in his mind, and he hoped that there would be enough money. He lost it with Resolution 2948, but he thought he had enough money that he would be able to get a couple of flexible posts, that he would be able to move around and have two or three individuals go to a country that says, yes, we're very serious about primary health care, and then he puts in these fine people to work with him. But I think he lost that capacity when 2948 was passed. Health for all, that's an intriguing... it's very difficult to comment on that, because I was surrounded by people who really downgraded the whole thing right away. I mean, they didn't... And I don't remember my own, I certainly did not have a gung-ho attitude towards it, but I didn't reflect on it either. We were talking about this also before lunch, that, you know, it's a very provocative thing. People to lead a social and economically productive life. That's a very rich phrase. And the whole social dimension that I was concentrating on. It would have been very interesting if WHO had explored what does that mean, a socially productive life. I think that would have opened up avenues of investigation that didn't happen, because many of the people who were enthusiastic about social found it hard to work their way into whatever. I mean, they, at the most extreme level, the disease-controlled people would say, I'm not interested in the social dimension unless it guarantees that I'll be able to decrease this disease's presence or whatever. I just, you know, none of this sociological, anthropological studies unless it automatically changes the behavior of people so that they accept to be vaccinated or that they accept the drugs that were given. The attitude was a, you know, tremendously conservative, anti-social attitude in a lot of the people that I knew at the time. So I think Health for All, I have the feeling that, you know, Alma-Ata came along, it was very convenient. It says primary health care is the key for Health for All. We didn't, you know, we're kind of a little vague on what we were meeting with primary health care in some circles, and now we say it's the key for something that we hadn't really explored deeply as to what it meant. So I don't know what happened subsequently. Yes, people were enthusiastic, because I think the incredible thing, which I recognized at the time, in spite of the fact that I wasn't very enthusiastic about all this documentation that went to Alma-Ata, people who were really sincere in wanting to move in that direction could find the phrase in the document that would say, WHO says this, right? And then they would go back to their countries and communities and say, WHO says this, and therefore we should be doing it. Right? So at that point I started realizing, well, maybe you don't need to wave the flag up about agrarian reform and all that kind of stuff. Maybe all you need to do is say equity and justice and social development, and the people out there who are sensitive to that will be able to pick up those words and move with it, which suggests you don't need new slogans, you just need to learn how to work with people who are sympathetic to the basic principles that you're talking about. Primary health care, I mean, the history now is selective primary health care came in the 80s. I think the loss of UNICEF partnership was disastrous. I think that was really tragic. And it seems, you know, Mahler and Grant could not even be in the same room with each other. They were two big personalities, and for whatever the reason, Grant wanted to move into something different. And that was it. People who knew them both tried to get them together, tried to find a way that, but it didn't happen. So once UNICEF went selective primary health care, they should have been the arm. They were, I mean, on paper, UNICEF was the arm that opened the door for WHO to be working with the other sectors, right? They had more direct access to the president. They had more natural intersectoral. WHO was always Minister of Health. Very hard, even though it says in the, you know, the WR can deal with anybody, still the WR is kind of a boxed in situation. And UNICEF should have been part of the opening wedge to get at the developmental issues that they were really interested in. Yes, I think.
I've got some more. Bernardino, and then the gentleman on your right, and then and then another one. Okay, sorry. So keep them going, Bernardino.
Yes, my name is Bernardino Fantini. I'm professor of history of medicine and health at the Geneva University. Thank you very much, Soko, for this very interesting historical sketch from inside. You describe this changing of strategies as a sort of pendulum oscillating permanently between two extremes. When you have this kind of metaphor, you should pay attention to two things. First, the nature of the object itself. As you said, it is quite difficult to define what primary health care is, was then, is now. I think this is the one important question. And the second objective, you should understand the forces that move the pendulum back and forth. So from this point of view, I wonder if something could be done more in order to understand what kind of forces make this pendulum oscillate so deeply. Of course, my idea that a synthesis can be possible between the two extremes. But let's say that this pendulum actually represents a sort of permanent dichotomy in every kind of public health strategy, even a national level. You always, in history, have these two different aptitudes, basic, horizontal, and vertical, top-down. This could be taken as a sort of a permanent reality in every kind of public health, from the very beginning, not only the League of Nations, but even the beginning of the 19th century, they had exactly the same problem. So I would like just to ask you about two questions. The first, you mentioned the social attitudes or social orientation as one side of the debate. How you define the other side? What is the model for the forces and the people that was opposing the social orientation? The second question, you mentioned that the holistic approaches. What do you mean with holistic? Because this is a very dangerous word, which has a very long story behind. I am not sure that we share the same definition of holistic. Third, I think one important thing that should be studied is the geographical dimension. Because we use usually horizontal, but what kind of horizontal are we using? Country level, regional level, village level, community level, they are not the same thing, and they are completely different, not only geographically, but also socially. I think that it is important to understand what kind of level we are talking about when we talk about primary healthcare. Finally, I think that your suggestion to understand the social dimensions of health. By the way, even there, I just shortly, social dimensions is not the same thing as social determinants. No. I think this is important. And the move of WHO towards social determinants, trying to understand the causes of bad or good health in a given situation is very important. It's much more engaging in relation to social dimensions. The idea to elaborate an historical review in each member state of what happened on primary health care is very clear. I am sure that the historical community could be very interested in doing something. But in order to avoid disparities, it could be useful to have a sort of a guidelines, a sort of questionnaire. What kind of question we should ask in order to try to make comparative analysis of primary health care strategies in different countries. And that could be a good work to do before we celebrate next year the 30th anniversary of Almada.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Jean-Jacques?
No, I think I'll pass it because he has so many questions.
All right. I think there are at least two others. Bederhan and Tracy Charu. Yes, after Bederhan. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Bederhan, a student. I'm current WHO staff. Literally, it was 1976 when I entered medical school. So while I was going anatomy and physiology on the one hand, and I went to medical school in Turkey, there was Professor Fishek who had been to Almaty and came back, and he enticed us all, and we went even in our summer holidays to the villages to spread the idea of primary care. And we went to the villages to ask their health needs, to discuss with them. And, you know, the thing that I had most surprising was that they wanted a wall around the graveyard so that the cows cannot enter and step over the graves. So this was an enlightening outcome of the primary care in our minds, but we then ended up rewriting the medical curriculum and curriculum for the midwives as medical students with our professors. So from this country reflection, I would like to come to the idea that you just phrased at the end. Maybe we should make a structural comparative impact assessment of the primary care histories in the world, not only by the historians of medicine, but also by the participants. And I think Socrates mentioned the blogs, use of blogs. If we can structure the internet technology in such a way, we can really ask people to contribute freely and then sift through all these ideas to see what really made an impact and change. And so in that sense, we can see all these models that you mentioned. You know, primary care meant different things to different people, but we can see what people took on their side. In Turkey, it was a political struggle, if you will. I mean, there was nationalization of health services, like nationalization of petroleum companies. But then at the end, the cost model did not suffice, and it broke down, and so forth. So you can all write individual histories or typology of histories of primary care. In that sense, it would be a multilateral or multiple history writing.
Thank you very much. Charu.
Yes, I'm Charu from EIP, and I think part of my question was after Lisa talked about the difference between the social determinant and the social cultural settings in the country. That's, I think, the most important thing, because one of the things that I see is like the way our medical education is structured currently, there is no way that you would expect people from the urban areas to really provide the primary care to, say, I'm an Indian, to the 70% of the population who's living in the rural areas. Where is the incentive system? There is lack of medicines, there's lack of human resources. How are we going to provide that? How are we going to work around it? One thing I feel WHO has always shied away and has not talked about is traditional medicine. That is the area which people understand in the community. That is the, we do call them, you know, less qualified or not qualified workers. But probably we can do something to provide incentives for them to become actually those qualified workers and be in that social setting where people are happy to go to them. They do not understand a language. If a doctor goes from an urban area, the people in the rural area does not understand the language of that person. So there are a lot of incentives and things that we need to work around before we can really talk about primary health care or health for all in this setting.
The last question I know of is from Norbert Trish. Thank you, Norbert.
I want to say that I keep being the one who always gets the last question or the last word. I'm Norbert Trish. I actually came to WHO when Bederhan probably just was about to finish his studies, so it was in the early 80s. And I'm still serving here. They somehow still keep me here. And I'm working in the Department of Human Resources for Health at the moment. I think, first of all, I'd like to thank both Sokol and Thompson for organizing this, because I think any institution that keeps track of its history has a future. I think it's very important that we try to learn from what we tried to do with primary health care in the specific instance in the past and now, which is being proposed to be revived. My question basically, and I think Dr. Pato may also have an answer to this, and Sokol, we now live in an age where we have three institutions dealing with one disease. We have a global fund for HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria, for example. We have a UN organization that deals with the organization around it. We have a thriving, I suppose, WHO HIV department around it. Now, we live probably at, I suppose, as you would say, at highest degrees of selectivity. All in all, these institutions command more resources than this entire organization, for example, can command over the biennium for 1 year. And my question is really, when we try to rethink now primary healthcare or integrated primary healthcare as it is proposed, what does this history actually tell us? What organizational frame did we have in the past, which I think, Sokol, you said, was incapable of getting the message somehow across and making primary healthcare thrive the way I think those people who wrote about it initially intended it to be. Where are we today, in 2007, dealing with, in some countries, if you want to do something about HIV in Tanzania, you have to deal with 32 institutions, partners, bilaterals, NGOs, etc., etc. So what kind of framework such as primary healthcare mean for us today? Because I think it's important that when we look at our reality today, where, by the way, looking at my area where I'm currently, you can also walk into a country and find that 60% of all nursing posts are vacant. Half of them have emigrated to countries in the north. The whole global labor market makes for primary healthcare as a real challenge. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Noble. Socrates.
That's a swirling.
I'm glad I don't have to answer those questions.
Well, Bernardino has said so many things. One of the conclusions with pointing out these four visions is to get away at least from this simple notion of vertical versus horizontal, and in some ways maybe to expand it to be a little more complicated in the sense of, and it links to holistic. I'm not the one using the word holistic. Holistic was what the expression that Amundsen used and others used at the time. And it nearly sounded like a game of can I be holier than you, if I can use that in that sense. And what I tried to do with that 4 points is to indicate that it was a little more complicated than a simple vertical versus horizontal. Something that occurred to me yesterday, but that I didn't include in what I said, was that I could also imagine that primary healthcare, the way it came out with this, you know, provocative, holistic kind of thing, may have really upset a lot of the progressive public health people at the time who had been struggling with the horizontal vertical dimension, but which had not, perhaps had not expanded their vision to incorporate rural development and education and whatever. They were confronting the real problem of what the Ministry of Health and the resources that countries had, how could they get to be together in a more effective and efficient way. And now Newell and company come along and make it even higher stakes. So I don't know whether the pendulum, from my perspective, Newell was the pendulum. So to say what force led Newell to come in 74 and become this he was always a provocative individual at every point, but what happened in 1974 and what happened in the health by the people to have it become, you know, this kind of provocation. That provocation wasn't there when I worked for him in 1967. Dev and I were there too. Maybe Dev saw a different Newell, but I don't remember Newell in 1970 provoking in the same way that he was provoking in 74. Did he have a, you know, were there forces operating on him in some way, or was he simply a very, very, he knew how to take advantage of certain situations, and in that sense, the pendulum, there were signs that this pendulum was moving, not only China, but there were other, you know, other things happening that this broader vision, and Mahler was picking up on the same theme, the new international economic order. The whole world was changing, the whole world seemed to be moving, you know, despite all the evidence to the contrary, there was, at least at the rhetorical level, things will seem to be moving in that direction. And of course, you're right that there must have been forces there. But what's incredible in the story for me is that if you did not have a Mahler, you had somebody else who was indifferent to those, you would not have had that those kind of statements coming out of the Director General. It would have been a different history, you know, as simple as that. So I don't know. But now the social determinants and social dimensions, I must admit, that's going through my head too in a way that I don't really have a clear picture of. What I remember, and these are anecdotal kind of things, is so many situations where when the word poverty was spoken, and it always turned out to be an American colleague, a CDC individual, and the minute the word poverty was said, their eyes closed over. Well, it was like, oh, what are you talking about? I can remember Henderson in a meeting with Nakajima. I don't remember why I was there, but Nakajima started talking about how important it was for us to be engaging this poverty issue, and Henderson was just wanting to jump out of the chair. He could, you know, it was, what's going on there? Right, so there are many, many situations of that kind. It has to do with what was said about rural-urban. It has to do with whether people can hear people, whether people go to visit villages and have that knack of being able to dialogue with them and get to understand that, you know, their problem. They really would like a wall around their cemetery. I don't know. Some people have it, some people don't, and I don't know whether that in itself is an issue of such, you know, whether that can be part of Jean-Jacques' educational campaign to make people socially sensitive to. So I don't have much to say on that. It's clear that, and it goes back, I guess, again to the point that I made earlier. You cannot expect all individuals, even majority of individuals in an organization, to be get turned on to an orientation. You're lucky if you have 10%. But then you have to find a way as an organization to build around the 10%. And that's why I say whether it's blogging or information systems, you have the flexibility enough that where things seem to be moving, where the nationals, whatever, whether it's regional, local, again, that's a point. I mean, I can remember Frank Schofield saying, every village has a power structure. You come in and you're talking about getting someone, the village, to nominate somebody to be trained as for a village health worker. If the village chief says that's the person, that's it. No, you're not going to question what the village chief says, whether that person is the most competent person of the village or not. It's not for us to question. You're stuck in a way with whatever it is that, you know, that choice is. So that issue of power, and is, of course, it applies. And I don't know about WHO. WHO has its hand full with dealing with national politicians and political will and whatever, and I presume it's on their shoulders that the local and community and village, and as Dr. Partho said before, you know, there's sensitive countries that seem to be moving in a direction of community, you know, listening to communities or not. If they're not, then forget it. I don't know if there were questions that I missed there. Yes, no, I don't have anything to say about today. I mean, if all these programs with their billions of dollars on these diseases were conquering the diseases, we should be standing there and applauding, clearly. But I guess it's WHO's mandate to go and show that maybe things are not any better, necessarily, in proportion to how much money is being spent. That things are not happening the way that they should be happening, and for the same reasons. I mean, that these people who have all that money may not know any more than anybody else about how to be effective at village level, at country level, whatever.
Socrates, there are two more, I think. Helen, and then, yes?
Thanks, I wasn't going to take the last word, but at least I'm not going to take the last word. My name is Helen Robinson.
Who are you?
Current staff member. And I'm very interested, because it resonates with some work that I see in WHO today. There's a kind of a tendency inside WHO always to look that the glass is half empty rather than the glass is half full. And I wonder if we actually looked, listening to what you're saying is very, very interesting, very provocative, but if you maybe kind of changed it a little bit, it might actually look a whole lot better.
I can't say anything. I'm a half-empty person.
I don't like to have the last word either, but I wanted just to respond very briefly. I think it's scandalous what's happening, in the sense that there are so many organizations working on the same issue, allocating resources without any understanding, mutual understanding between them at least, on how to do better. At country level, I think the only authority that can guarantee a coordination is the government. And WHO role in this respect, if they can play a role by strengthening the government in its effort to coordinate these inputs, that's all what we can do. And in the meantime, not to really take so seriously as it has been said by Dr. Litsios, not to take very seriously the mandate that we are the coordinating agency, right. Because nobody accepts that. We have to realize nobody else from the people who are involved in health would accept it at its letter value. So we'll have to be modest, we'll have to give more and understand the others and try to help them. At country level, most important, and then also we'll have to try at the other levels to really make more effort to bring people together. So this is one, and I would like to add to our colleague here that we should not really end with a kind of line of criticism to primary health care. The end result of this meeting, I think, should highlight the importance. As you have said, I agree that it was really a social revolution within health and medicine, primary health care and health for all, after all. And it has introduced new ideas to the now, some people benefited from it, others there are failures, but I think we'll have to look forward for really benefiting and learning the lessons and moving forward from that.
Did you like the last word?
No, that sounded good to me.
Well, did I get the last word? I'll just make the last word, which is a word of thanks to everybody. But we've had about 14 or 15 of these seminars now, remarkably, over the last 18 months or so. And this has been one of the most provocative and fascinating and thought-provoking of them all, and the discussion has been right up there at the very top. So I think we should thank our speaker, again, Socrates, and thank ourselves for the questions and the answers and the discussion.
Well. Thank you.